Hello, everyone. This is Bob Seda. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'll be reading for you today in digest form CQ Magazine for February 2009. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handyham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or the email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Again, my name is Bob Zeta. My QTH, or geographic location, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We'll begin today in Zero Bias, a CQ editorial titled, It's Not the Network, or Is It? The author is Richard Mosslin, W2VU, editor of CQ Magazine. The bones of this editorial have been clattering around inside my head for several months, but until now, I hadn't gotten around to fleshing it out. It's a good thing, too, because now that I am, it's going in a completely different direction than I first thought it would. Chances are you have seen the ads from a certain wireless phone company in which the user is followed around by about 100 company workers, making sure he always has reliable service. It's the network, says the ad copy. My first thought when this theme began appearing in the company's ads was, here's where ham radio is different. We don't need the network. On a rare occasion when the network goes down, we hams can fire up our rigs and continue to communicate. The fixed infrastructure of the network is what makes it vulnerable to overload or failure at the times of greatest need. Ham radio's flexibility, on the other hand, is what makes our service stand out in those same times. But the more often I've seen these ads, the more I've realized that my initial impression was wrong. As the pictures tell a different story than the words, while the words talk about the network, the pictures are of people. More than repeaters and antennas, the network is kept reliable by the people who build and maintain it. This visible message, as any television producer will tell you, is at least as powerful as the verbal message. And in this sense, ham radio is no different. It is not our transceivers and repeaters and antennas that gives our service its legendary reliability when all else fails. It is our people. People who have the right equipment, knowledge, and training to meet the needs of the moment. People who can sit up and operate communications networks on the fly and keep them running for as long as needed. Depending on what we need to do, we can use HF or VHF, make contacts direct or via relays, and use code, voice, text, or video to get our messages through. A growing number of these options require a physical infrastructure, a network, in order to work. Repeaters and satellites need to be built and maintained. Satellites need to be built, launched, and controlled. Repeater networks need to have links established and maintained. This network infrastructure is a large part of what makes ham radio work on an everyday basis. Keep in mind that 99% of the time we are not responding to an emergency or disaster, but it is these everyday contacts that keep us prepared for that other critical 1%. Also, of course, we have our own network of people, like in the TV ad, who design, build, and maintain the components of our physical networks. And the growth of this infrastructure is expanding the horizons of our everyday operating. Now, under the thought of stretching the network, on VHF and UHF, the basic unit of our infrastructure is the repeater. These automatic relay stations allow us to use handhelds and relatively low-powered mobile radios to keep in touch with each other over a wide area, such as a city or a county. Sometimes, though, it isn't quite enough. There may be dead spots that limit coverage. In response, some repeater owners have added remote receivers along with voting devices that automatically select the receiver with the strongest signal to be relayed to the transmitter. To stretch further, a growing number of repeater owners are linking their systems, expanding their range to cover entire metropolitan areas, large semi-rural or rural areas, and even multiple cities. This has been common practice for many years in some parts of the country, but has recently been expanding elsewhere. There's one network of linking repeaters in New York City that covers all five boroughs plus Long Island and New Jersey suburbs. There is another in New Jersey that connects much of the state. The next logical step is to link together multiple linked systems. This has resulted in wide area networks in some parts of the country, and in the rise of Internet-linked networks such as IRLP, that's the Internet Radio Linking Project, or Echolink. The capabilities of these networks are simply astounding. Example, I was recently asked to be a guest on a net in New England that covers much of that region through a traditional linked repeater system. It is also connected to both an Echolink conference node and an IRLP reflector, which together allow check-ins from all over the world. On the night I visited this net via Echolink from my computer, since I wasn't close enough to make a direct RF connection, we were joined by hams from all over the United States, including several coming in from a repeater in Alaska, as well as two hams from Scotland and one from Australia. It was a worldwide link up on a scale that I had never experienced before, and it brought a whole new dimension to my hamming. It was indeed the network, both the equipment and the people coming together to add to my enjoyment of this great hobby. I look forward to using Echolink and IRLP more often to keep in contact with hams around the world, especially while waiting for those dang sunspots to start showing up again in sizable numbers. 73 W2VU, Rich Mawson. It's time now to take a look at ham radio news. Antenna notes. The city of San Diego, California, was considering a new rule in January that would, for the first time, subject amateur radio antennas to height restrictions normally applicable only to buildings and other structures. According to Newsline, if the ordinance is approved, hams with non-compliant antennas would have to apply for a very expensive and time-consuming Process 3 site development permit. Across the country, a ham in Penn Township, Pennsylvania, has won a battle to keep his 53-foot tower. According to the Tribune Review newspaper, the Township Zoning Board had originally granted a permit to Charles Mills, called W3YNI, last March, then declared it invalid in July, when neighbors complained, and reissued it in August with some modifications. The neighbors filed an appeal, and on December 11th, the Zoning Hearing Board voted unanimously to deny the appeal. A further appeal is possible, but considered unlikely. New York City Museum Ham Station threatened with closure. Another museum-based ham station is in danger of being closed down permanently. The Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club, HOSARC, has run a demonstration at the New York City Science Museum on the 1964-65 World's Fair site for more than 35 years. Now, according to club officials, the museum is undergoing a major renovation and has a new director who does not see the ham radio exhibit as being a priority. The club has started an online petition to urge museum officials to keep the station on the air. It may be found at www.tinyurl.com/6LJOST. Why don't you check that out if you feel like you can do some support with them. IARU Region 1 adopts new 40-meter band plan. Region 1 of the International Amateur Radio Union, IARU, has adopted a new 40-meter band plan for hams in Europe and Africa in advance of the expansion of the 40-meter band in that region from 7,000 to 7,100 kilohertz to 7,000 to 7,200 kilohertz this coming March 29, adapted at the region's triennial conference in Croatia in late November. The plan designates 7,000 through 7025 kilohertz as CW slant contest preferred, sets a QRP center of activity at 7030 kilohertz, and has narrow mode digital modes operating between 7040 and 7050 kilohertz. The plan suggests voice operating between 7050 and 7200 kilohertz with SSB contest preferred areas at 7060 through 7100 and 7130 through 7200. IARU band plans offer voluntary gentlemen's agreements and do not carry the force of law. According to the ARRL, the Region 1 Conference also urged contest sponsors to add a youngsters and newcomers category whenever possible, and call for replacing signal reports in contest exchanges with some other less predictable exchange, so as to enhance the skill requirements of contest operators. If you want to check your watch from Canada, CHU moves to new frequency. Another result of the expansion of the 40-meter ham band in Europe and Africa to 7,200 kilohertz as of March 29 is the relocation of the 41-meter international broadcast band to 7,200 through 7,350 kilohertz. As broadcasters began relocating, Canadian Time and Frequency Standard Station CHU, a decades-long fixture on 7335 kHz, began experiencing significant interference. As a result, Canada's National Research Council, which runs CHU, decided to move the station's frequency to 7850 kHz, 7850 kHz. Effective January 1, 2009. So, if you're having trouble finding CHU at 7335, try tuning up to 7850. Three prominent hams are silent keys. The man who wrote Scratchy, S-C-R-A-T-C-H-I, for CQ Magazine over the course of four decades has died. George H. Floyd, Jr., called WA4DGA, was an engineer and executive with General Electric in Lynchburg, Virginia, not Phoenix, Arizona, comments of the editor, until his retirement. His true identity was revealed after his passing on November 22. The Scratchy column featured a politically incorrect, by today's standards, Japanese-American ham writing in fractured English and regularly skewering the pomposity and poor operating practices he encountered on the air. For many years, Floyd was also the pseudonymous author of Lighthouse Larry in GE Employee Publications. We will be presenting a tribute to Scratchy in an upcoming issue. On November 25, ARRL President Emeritus George Wilson, called W4OYI, became a silent key. Wilson served as ARRL President from 1992 to 1995 when he stepped down after suffering a stroke. He remained active on the air and in public service emergency communication until his death. Wilson was also a judge on the Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award Committee. The following day, Gene Harlan called WB9MMM, editor and publisher of ATV Quarterly magazine, passed away from the effects of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Harlan also sold amateur television equipment and software, made name badges, and was the founder of Cyber Ham magazine in the mid-1990s. FCC asks hams for help with DTV transition. The Federal Communications Commission has asked hams around the country to serve as resources for neighbors having trouble with this month's conversion to digital television, DTV. The request, made to the ARRL in early December, was passed along to radio clubs. The FCC is asking hams to answer questions and distribute technical information and FCC handouts. ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager Alan Pitts, W1HGP, stressed that hams should not make house calls, help directly with installations, or sell DTV converters. Some hams feel the FCC should not be calling on them to do its dirty work. Others see this as an excellent opportunity to provide positive public relations for amateur radio. You could take a look at WB0NOA's op-ed titled Be a DTV Ambassador on page 52 of this issue of QST for February 2009. Folks, this is your reader Bob, N1BLF, commenting to this. The FCC has actually changed that again. It's now going, I think, another 4 months, sometime into June of 2009. I'm recording this on the 9th of February here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and I just heard that, and maybe I saw it on TV also, but it's not really going to affect till sometime in June of 2009. So let's continue with ham radio news. South Africa set to launch second ham satellite. South Africa's second satellite, a ham radio satellite known as Sumbandilasat, that's a long word, S-U-M-B-A-N-D-I-L-A-S-A-T, Sumbandilasat, was slated to be launched from Russia sometime between December 2008 and March 2009. According to AMSAT News Service, it will operate in conjunction with the University of Stellenbosch Software-Defined Receiver Project. It will carry a VHF slant UHF transponder with a 2-meter uplink and a 70-centimeter downlink, a parrot repeater, and that's a voice digipeater, and a voice beacon. Updated information should be available on the SA-AMSAT website at www.amsatsa.org.za/. Folks, you know, I try to make this an easy-to-listen-to digest format reading of a ham radio magazine. CQ for February 2009 really arrived at my QTH or location here in Massachusetts quite late. I received the gist yesterday, which would have been February 8. That's a late arrival for a magazine that says February 2009 on it. Most of the magazines, as most of you, I'm sure, have experienced in your lifetime of subscriptions, usually come sometime toward the middle of the previous month. So, because of that, some of the information in here is really not very timely. Most of it is very good, but here's one thing that brings this to my mind. It's a really big article, really beautifully done, and it's titled Ham Radio Groundhog Day. It's by Henry Hill, called WA3CVC. Now, you probably know where I'm going with this dissertation already. Groundhog Day just passed us sometime last week. And with all the effort in this beautifully put together article, I've got to tell you, all kinds of beautiful photographs and all that stuff. I can't read it. It would be too long anyway for a digest. But I want to share one thing with you about it. And it's 5:46 a.m. in the morning right now on a Sunday. But it got me chuckling, so I hope it gets you chuckling, too. It's about Groundhog Day. For those readers who may not be familiar with American traditions, Groundhog Day is not really an American tradition, but most Americans don't know that. It is an adaptation of a European tradition brought here by German settlers in the 1700s. February 2nd is known as Candlemas Day, halfway between the winter solstice in December and the spring equinox in March. By tradition dating back before Christianity in Europe, according to the Stormfacts Weather Almanac website, nice weather on Candlemas Day meant the rest of the winter would be cold and stormy. A cloudy Christmas Day, on the other hand, was supposed to foretell early arrival of springtime weather. Following in that tradition, it was believed that if an animal saw its shadow on Candlemas Day, there would be 6 more weeks of winter weather. 18th century Germans, according to Stormfacts, watched badgers to see if they cast shadows. When large numbers of Germans emigrated to Pennsylvania, they brought along this tradition, but substituted the more common groundhog as their weather forecast. According to the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club, the Groundhog Day tradition there began in 1886, with the first trek to Gobbler's Knob coming in 1887 and continuing every year since. The Groundhog Club website claims 100% accuracy for Phil's forecast. However, Stormfacts compared them with actual Pennsylvania weather and determined that he's been right only 39% of the time. roughly the same level of accuracy of many human weather forecasters. That's courtesy of Rich Mawson, W2VU. So you see, folks, even here in the dark of night in good old New England, with snow on the ground since before Christmas Eve, I believe, we don't always appreciate the groundhog, do we? You know, while I'm handing out accolades for our beautiful work in this magazine, CQ, we have a CQ market survey. It begins on page 18. And I have to tell you again, somewhat the same wordage that I used a few moments ago. Talk about a magazine publisher making a super effort to give the consumer of the magazine, the reader, that's you and me, information about things. This article is titled VHF / UHF Handhelds. It's actually by an old friend of ours at the Carriage Handyham System, Gordon West, called WB6NOA. Now, as I suggested, this article runs 8 to 10 pages. Beautifully done. I'm not going to read it for you, but if you're in the market, as we say, for a 2-meter or any kind of a handheld, they're all here. And Gordon takes every one of them apart categorically on this CQ market survey for VHF, UHF handhelds. It's well worth you reading this material or having someone read it with you and sharing the information with you if you're interested in perhaps a new, small, handy talkie. Begins on page 18 of CQ, February 2009. Gordon starts it by saying, it has been 3 years since we field tested VHF and UHF handhelds. And the best news is there has been no substantial increase in handheld pricing. Single banders, new, sell for as low as $99. Several dual banders are under $199. Tri-banders are around $260. Quad banders, under $299. And you can go all digital, starting in the mid-$300 range. This year, our HD buyer's market survey is divided into the following categories. Single band HDs, dual banders and two banders, tri-banders, quad banders, including shortwave receive, and digitals. First, some highlights of what to come. Some dual banders are actually less expensive than a single band HD, and definitely less than two single band HDs. There is a big difference between two bands and dual band. Dual banders let you monitor two frequencies at once, generally one on each band, while two banders give you only one at a time. Go for a dual bander if you need simultaneous reception on VHF and UHF. Got shortwave? Can a little HD with shortwave receive pull in shortwave and AM radio bands well? Finally, going digital with ICOM D-Star technology is the proven data system. Now, too, Yaesu has an Empress HD, while the Kenwood D7 has vanished. D-Star positioning by itself will keep you from getting lost, and our field review takes a look at the offerings of each individual HT. Well worth it. Great job from Gordon West, WB6NOA. And believe me, it's all in there, folks. Now, continuing with the CQ Magazine February 2009 Digest here on the Carriage Handyham System, we have the results of the 2008 CQ Worldwide VHF Contest. This article compiled by John Lindholm, called W1XX. It begins on page 30 and goes through page 33. So if you were actively involved in that Worldwide VHF Contest, again, you might want to work your way toward looking at that material to see if you actually were in the running for top honors. Buried inside that article is a little piece by Bill Champagne called N1HRA. It's titled Ocean State 2-Meter FM Simplex Challenge. The concept of 2-Meter FM Simplex Contest, it was hatched within the confines of an amateur radio emergency service group in Charlestown, Rhode Island. That's an ARIS group. The objective was to test FM simplex coverage in support of the local emergency management agency. Further, with many newly licensed hams confined to 2 meters FM, training in making rapid-fire QSOs was desired. in step the established CTRI contest group, a sponsor of now statewide and more competition. Research on the web reveals similar activities by clubs in Milwaukee and the Twin Cities, which provided valuable guidance in drawing up rules for the so-called challenge. Running concurrent with the CQ Worldwide VHF contest would assure some level of success, which proved accurate. To concentrate activity, 7 so-called focus hours, split between Saturday evening and Sunday afternoon, were incorporated into the rules. Geographical boundaries of local grid squares, as the default VHF contest exchange, was provided along with a list of 3-letter abbreviations for the 39 statewide cities and towns, which were also included in the exchange. Multipliers were cities, slant, towns, plus grid squares, plus other states. Acting as a wild card were bonus points for working the CTRI club call. Call was WA1RR, which was active during each of the focus hours from 7 different locations scattered across the state of Rhode Island. To further ARIS purposes, bonus points were also offered for operating at least some of the time on battery, slant, generator, slant, solar. The rules and entry forms for email submission in Microsoft Word format were posted on the club website. The results were gratifying. At least 38 stations participated with activity reported in 21 Rhode Island cities and towns, 6 grid squares, and 4 states plus 3 rovers and a maritime mobile. Almost all of the stations active had never operated in a contest before, or very little. Gaining familiarity with grid squares was a positive result. The results were emailed to each contestant and posted on the club website, with certificates being mailed to all who submitted logs. Many newcomers were exposed to the joy of contest operating with the added potential of gaining some additional members for the club. Other groups may want to tap this potential source of contest operators. The author of this short piece is Bill Champagne. Bill is Vice President, CTRI Contest Group. His call is November 1, Hotel Romeo Alpha and 1HRA from the Little Roadie in Rhode Island. I don't think I've ever mentioned Rhode Island in the years I've been recording digests. And when I saw the Ocean State, to me that rang a bell, because we're about 25 miles due east toward Cape Cod from Providence, Rhode Island. As we turn through the pages of CQ for February 09, Washington readout. The information here is by Frederick O. Maia, M-A-I-A. Fred's call is W-5-Y-I. He titles this House Committee Report Blasts FCC Chairman. Congressional investigation charges Kevin Martin abused power. House Democrats, led by Representatives John D. Dingell, Democrat Michigan Chairman of the Committee on Energy and Commerce, and Bart Stupak, Democrat Michigan Chairman of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, have released a blistering assessment of FCC Chief Kevin Martin's leadership. One of the items cited has been of direct interest to hams. The report was released in early December, just a month before Martin would lose his chairmanship with the changeover in presidential administrations. Early in 2009, Democrats will have the majority on the 5-member commission. Martin, 41, an appointee of President George W. Bush, must step aside after President-elect Barack Obama is inaugurated January 20 and names a replacement. Bush appointed Martin, a Harvard Law School graduate, to the commission in 2001 and named him chairman in 2005. The 110-page investigative report entitled Deception and Distrust, the Federal Communication Commission under Chairman Kevin J. Martin, close quote, details findings of the House Energy and Commerce Committee's Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee. The House Commerce Committee has the principal responsibility for legislative oversight relating to the telecommunications industry. Nearly a year in the making, the report is the culmination of a supposedly bipartisan investigation into the FCC's regulatory processes and management practices. It was formally launched on January 8, 2008, in response to complaints about the agency from the public and communications industry professionals and from external and internal information about how items were brought to a vote. 84 of the report's 110 pages were emails, memos, and letters included to support the findings. Initially, the examination began as a bipartisan effort, but Republicans dropped out when it became clear that the report would have partisan political overtones. The ranking Republican on the committee, Joe L. Barton, Republican, Texas, initially supported the study but later dropped out. Investigators poured over thousands of records, documents, and emails and conducted interviews with current and former FCC employees, as well as members of the telecommunications industry. The FCC said it cooperated in the investigation, which required 11,620 hours of work from more than 600 FCC employees who provided the committee staff with more than 9,000 emails and approximately 75 boxes containing nearly 170,000 pages of documents. Ooh. Among other things, the report charged abuse of power, suppression of information, rewriting reports, ignoring warnings, reversing findings, overcharging consumers, and manipulation of data that could have changed the outcome of some proceedings. The report claims that commission staffers suffered from a climate of fear and extreme micromanagement. Every decision, no matter how trivial, had to go through Martin's office for approval. This included all staff appointments, the report said, meaning that it could play a role in the commission's failure to date to name a replacement to special counsel for amateur radio Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, who retired last July. The report added that FCC employees were afraid to disagree with Martin's conclusions due to their concern of being demoted. The result, it said, was a demoralized, ineffective agency. The article's author, Frederick O. Meyer, called W5YI, continues with explicit detail about many other ramifications of the circumstances relative to the changes at the Federal Communications Commission. It concludes on page 37, so it's a very in-depth article. We have an announcement now. The 2009 CQ Worldwide WPX Contest for single sideband will be March 28-29. Starting at zero, Greenwich Mean Time, GMT, Saturday. The CW, Morse code portion, May 30 through 31, 2009. It ends at 23:59, GMT on Sunday, May 31st. All the details are there for operating, signing, filing, and looking for the results on a future issue of CQ Magazine. I have a piece here titled, More Potpourri. It's by Erwin Math, M-A-T-H, W-A-2-N-D-M. Erwin calls this Math's Notes. Last month, we brought you our soapbox preaching, which I like to do from time to time. And I thank you for your indulgence. This month, I would like to discuss some additional items that might be of interest to you, starting with the effects of RF. We are aware, or should be aware, of the damage that too much RF can do to our bodies. Although specific dangerous levels have not been adequately documented, there is no doubt that at some level we had better be careful. A common microwave oven, for example, can be thought of as a 2.5 gigahertz 750 watt transmitter, and we know what this can do to a chicken in the RF field. Well, a Bluetooth, that's registered trademark headset worn on your ear, linked to your cell phone is also a transmitter, but in this case, one that happens to be located less than an inch from your brain. Now, I know the manufacturers say that there is no danger, since the RF level for such a device is very low, and many people wear them as a sort of badge of coolness. But again, please be careful. There are no valid long-term studies or guarantees as to what the effects will be on the wearer after 10 to 20 years of this sort of exposure, even at low power. The same also goes for your handy-talky, HD, although not in contact with your head, not usually anyway. Many do produce as much as 5 watts of RF a foot or so from your brain, so again, be careful. As far as your home station is concerned, the old adage that the higher the antenna is, the better it performs is true from the safety angle as well. In this aspect, the higher it is, the further away from you it is, and therefore everyone benefits. In conclusion, certainly use all of these devices when you wish, but do not expose yourself to RF at any level when it isn't necessary. Now, regarding digital versus analog, it is obvious that this is truly becoming a digital age. Some even say that analog is either dead or dying. I wonder, however, if we are giving up something in the transition. A CD, compact disc, is truly amazing in that it can be played again and again without any noticeable degradation as compared with an analog record, but it is a sampled reproduction of the music it contains. An analog recording, on the other hand, is a smooth copy with no steps. Now, I am well aware that digital theory says that if you sample a signal at twice the highest frequency present, the Nyquist criteria, all of the information in the signal will be retained. But remember that music is not a single tone. There are overtones and who knows what else. That is part of the reason why a piano sounds like a piano, and a trumpet playing the same exact note still sounds like a trumpet. Most CDs are sampled at 44.1 kilohertz, well above the maximum of 20 kilohertz that humans are supposed to be able to hear. So why the difference? Why is it that most professional musicians can easily distinguish between a digital and analog recording? Maybe the harmonics, and who knows what else, beyond the range of human hearing, have something to do with it. You might remember that last time we spoke at length about technology for technology's sake. Since that time, I would like to relate two incidents that occurred coincidentally. My wife has an older 1995 vintage luxury car, named withheld on purpose, that suddenly developed a fault in the directional signal blinker. Upon investigation, we found that a so-called directional module had failed. Fortunately, this was a plug-in device, and since the replacement part was more than $150 from the dealer, we proceeded to open the defective unit. Inside was a relay, a 24-pin IC, microprocessor, some diodes, capacitors, and a few surface-mounted components, as well as a power relay. The trouble, unfortunately, turned out to be a simple unsoldered or broken wire at the terminal pin of the relay coil. 1 or 2 seconds with the soldering iron solved the problem, and we were back in business. My point, however, is why this entire complex assembly was even created, when in the old days, a simple $2 flasher did the same job. Mind you, this module did nothing else except blink the directional lamps on the car when activated. In a similar fashion, a friend had the heater air conditioner blower fail in his car. The dealer repaired this for many hundreds of dollars and gave him the so-called blown-out parts, which he then brought to me out of curiosity. The blower assembly consisted of a motor and plastic blower wheel connected to some sort of control assembly that looked just like a 15-amp diode bridge attached to a heavy heatsink. Disconnecting the control assembly and connecting 12 volts directly to the blower motor terminals immediately indicated that the motor was indeed quite good. Opening the assembly with a pair of pliers and chisel revealed a couple of heavy diodes, a small 1N4002 style diode, and something that looked like an SCR. The 1N4002 style part was open. Again, replacing the diode with an actual N14002 solved the problem. Even if labor costs were $100 per hour, this sort of repair should have cost $101. I'm not trying to criticize the auto manufacturers or any others for that matter, but why make everything so complex? It seems to me that manufacturers really want servicing to be reduced to just replacing expensive assemblies. Today, fixing only what is broken, it seems, has become a lost art. Just replace it in the modern way. I hate to constantly bring up the past, but back in the so-called good old days, individuals at least tried to repair things that had failed. People were not afraid to open any defective product to see what went wrong, and repair shops were plentiful. In particular, as amateur radio operators, we always opened our equipment to see what was going on behind our front panel, even when it wasn't broken. What has happened? I believe that we, as a society, have gotten lazy, and if we don't wake up, as I mentioned last month, we will become a race of consumers purchasing whatever technology those in the know want to sell to us, whether we need it or not. It's signed 73 Irwin, W-A-2-N-D-M, Maths Notes. As we continue today, let's talk about some public service information. An article here, it's all about the weather. The author is Bob Jesuit, called W-A-3-P-Z-O. It features Skywarn, S-K-Y-W-A-R-N. Ham radio operators from around the country participated in the annual Skywarn Recognition Day. The National Weather Service recognizes the importance of ham radio operators during weather conditions. It seems as if we are always talking about weather emergencies and natural disasters either here in the United States or around the world. This month's column is no different as we take a look at some weather happenings and disaster preparedness. In early December, amateur radio operators around the country and many National Weather Service offices participated in the National Skywarn Recognition Day. Since 1999, the event celebrates the contributions that volunteer Skywarn radio operators make to the National Weather Service. Sponsored by the National Weather Service and the ARRL, both organizations recognize the importance that amateur radio operators provide during severe weather. Steve Neglick, a warning coordination meteorologist at the NWS Weather Forecast Office in Columbia, South Carolina, told local amateur radio operators, quoting, "We really appreciate all the assistance you have given us this past year, and your help has allowed us to provide better service to the public and our other customers. The March 15th supercell outbreak was a testament to your vital support, as the information we received from spotters helped us to provide timely warnings and save lives." The supercell thunderstorm is potentially the most dangerous of the convective storm types. According to the National Weather Service, storms possessing this structure have been observed to generate the vast majority of long-lived, strong and violent, that's F2 through F5 tornadoes, as well as downburst damage and large hail. Yulio Ripold, WD4R, Assistant National Hurricane Center Amateur Radio Coordinator for WX4NHC, thanked members for the VOIP, Voice over Internet Protocol, Hurricane Net, for their effort and time during Hurricane Paloma, especially as the hurricane tracked through the Cayman Islands. According to Ripold, the information relayed by YourNet gave the Hurricane Center forecasters additional insight into what Cayman residents were actually going through. Your multitasking, multi-mode methods of combining Echolink and IRLP VOIP, HF monitoring, internet web blogs, and direct email was a great example of information gathering without limitations. He continued, "These hybrid communications efforts before and during the hurricane to contact hams and non-hams were successful in promoting awareness that they had alternate means of sending and receiving hurricane information during the event. Some of these new contacts will be better prepared for future storms because of your interaction with them during Paloma. Some may become hams." Ripoli said they worked many NWS stations on HF, APRS, and Echolink IRLP. Stations worked were as close as Florida and as far away as Australia. CQ asked Ripoll about the value of Skywarn Recognition Day. He said the SRD is both fun and very useful for HAMS and the NWS as a joint exercise for possible future operations during severe weather and communications outage backup. An example of the importance of a HAMP radio station at the National Weather Service office during severe weather was during Hurricane Katrina. During Katrina, NWS Slidell lost all communications with the outside world except for HAMP radio. They were able to establish and maintain contact with WX4NHC and others around the country with real-time weather reports and let them know their damage and personal conditions. The first Skywarn recognition day was in 1999. Meteorologist in charge of Goodland, Kansas, NWS office, Scott Metzger and Zero QE, developed a way to recognize the valuable contribution storm spotters make to the National Weather Service. Since many of those spotters were also hams, Floyd said, it seemed like a natural fit for the recognition to be centered on amateur radio. Each year, the effects of severe weather are felt by many Americans. To obtain critical weather information, NOAA's National Weather Service, NWS, part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, established the Skywarn program. Skywarn, a volunteer program with nearly 280,000 trained severe weather spotters, helps keep communities safe by providing timely and accurate reports of severe weather to the National Weather Service. Although Skywarn spotters provide essential information for all types of weather hazards, the main responsibility of a Skywarn spotter is to identify and describe severe local storms. According to the National Weather Service, 10,000 severe thunderstorms, 5,000 floods, and more than 1,000 tornadoes occur across the United States each year. These events threaten lives and property. Since the program started in the 1970s, the information provided by Skywarn spotters, coupled with Doppler radar technology and improved satellite and other data, has enabled the National Weather Service to issue more timely and accurate warnings for tornadoes, severe thunderstorms, and flash floods. According to the NWS, Skywarn storm spotters are part of the ranks of citizens who form the nation's first line of defense against severe weather. There can be no finer reward than to know that their efforts have given communities the precious gift of time, seconds, and minutes that can help save lives. Now, as regards to who is eligible, the NWS encourages anyone with an interest in public service and access to communications, such as amateur radio, to join the Skywarn program. Volunteers also include police and fire personnel, dispatchers, EMS workers, public utility workers, and other concerned private citizens. Individuals affiliated with hospitals, schools, churches, and nursing homes, or who have a responsibility for protecting others, are also encouraged to become a spotter. Now, as to how you can get involved. The NWS has 122 local weather forecast offices, each with a warning coordination meteorologist who is responsible for administering the Skywarn program in his or her local area. You can contact your local Ares or RACIS group to find out who the local amateur radio Skywarn coordinator is, or contact your local Weather Service office. Many local NWS websites have a link to the local Skywarn program. Training to become a spotter is conducted by the local offices and covers information on thunderstorm development, storm structure, and identifying potential severe weather features. In addition, you will be taught what information to report and how to report it. Classes are free and typically are about 2 hours long. While the Skywarn training program provides you with all of the information you need to become a storm spotter, many members of Skywarn have an interest in expanding their knowledge of the weather. One way of doing this is to attend a meeting of a local chapter of the American Meteorological Society, AMS. According to the AMS, local chapters have been a part of the Society's framework almost from the beginning of the organization, with the first chapter formed in Boston in 1929. The local chapters were viewed from the start as an effective means of increasing the awareness of meteorology among the general public, as well as providing a mechanism for local gatherings of professional and weather enthusiasts that would ultimately lead to a growth in society membership. The society now has approximately 125 active local chapters, including over 40 student chapters that specifically serve the needs of meteorology students. The AMS also sponsors a certification program for broadcast meteorologists. The 2008 hurricane season was barely over, and some forecasters were suggesting that new types of warnings should be issued in 2009. Hurricane Ike, the most destructive storm in the 2008 hurricane season, was not classified as a major hurricane using the yardstick forecasters have used for decades. However, Ike produced a catastrophic storm surge and ranks as the third costliest tropical system to strike the United States in 150 years, behind only Hurricanes Katrina and Andrews. Some forecasters are considering modifying the Saffir-Simpson scale. Ike was only ranked a Category 2 hurricane on the scale. Hurricane scientists meeting in Miami in mid-December, as this is being written, will discuss and perhaps act on a proposal to develop a new scale for classifying hurricanes that better accounts for storm surge. Gene Heffel, meteorologist in charge of the Houston-Galveston office of the National Weather Service, who is proposing the modification, told the Houston Chronicle that it is not an easy issue, but I believe a change must be made. He continued, bad decisions were made during Ike, and both citizens and officials based on the notion that Ike was a Category 2 storm and a feeling that I have been through a lot worse. It is hard to convince people that they could face certain death when they see that a storm is not even considered to be a major hurricane. Storm surge is determined more by the size of the hurricane than by its wind speed. National Hurricane Center Director Bill Reed, KB5FYA, has been noncommittal on a possible change. However, he eventually wants to deliver risk information on forecast winds and storm surge, perhaps by zip code, to residents within the potential path of a hurricane. The pros and cons of the Saffir-Simpson scale will be discussed at April's National Hurricane Conference in Austin, Texas. Now here in CQ for February 2009, a category World of Ideas by Dave Ingram, called K4TWJ, is titled Hamming from the Shadows. It's part 6. Now, of course, here on the Courage Handy Ham system, we haven't been reading CQ magazine up until about a month or so ago, so we really haven't heard what the other five parts would be. It's really all about CC and Rs. Just give you a little of that and then some other more factual information in about a minute. Your interest in our series of articles on undercover hamming continues to be quite high, indicating we are filling a definite need in this area of growing concern. In light of that fact, both this month's and next month's columns present more views and notes of encouragement to overcome CC and Rs and keep on hamming. Do you live far enough outside of a big city so that installing antennas and hamming to the max is no problem? Enjoy your good fortune while you can and hope that situation holds true for many years hence. We are noticing, however, health concerns, job changes, economic variations, etc., causing more people, both young adults and retirees, to move closer to more populated areas and into gated communities, highly restricted subdivisions, and condos with CC&Rs galore. When doing so, new arrivals are required to sign away numerous taken-for-granted privileges, such as installing amateur radio antennas. Unfortunately, the public services we provide during hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. are favorably accepted, the Katrina factor, but our antennas are forbidden. Do not despair, however, as every cloud has a silver lining, if you are willing to pursue it. A good example of that fact appeared in the November 2008 issue of QSD on page 54. Call sign W1WSN moved into a condo in CC&Rs infested Florida. No antennas, no wires, no poles, just sit there. Researched his situation, devised a simple multiband screwdriver-type vertical antenna, and delivered an extensive presentation to the condo's board of directors. He then paid all board-mandated charges for professional installation, and his antenna was approved. Every case of CCNRs is different, however, so my philosophy is first and foremost to devise a good plan B, hidden antenna, and then prepare papers explaining amateur radio's fine history of public service and propose installation of an antenna. Now, for the listener, the author summarizes how you survive CCNRs. First of all, maintaining a low profile. Two major factors must be addressed for successfully hamming from the shadows, using an unnoticed or transparent to untrained eyes antenna, and ensuring you are not discovered through interference to home electronics. Items falling in this category include stereos, surround sound TV systems, programmable heat, cooling thermostats, inexpensive telephones, and the worst items of all, touch lamps. Knowledge is everything here. A wealth of superb must-read information is available at www.arrl.org/news/RFI/neighbors.html, and there are several other sites quoted. If you have computer capabilities, you can print out copies of this information from the ARRL, which also includes information from their fine book, RF Interference Handbook. You should read it carefully and keep that and all other information handy for quick future reference if and when you are confronted with interference complaints. Be sure your own house, that's TV, stereo, telephones, etc., is clean of interference from your rig. Modern transceivers and linear amplifiers are usually spectrally clean, and strong cable TV signals usually deliver such high-level signals to TVs. Cases of old-style TV interference have become rather scarce. Today's problems typically result from sheer induction field RF overloads. You minimize induction field overload and open-air coupling of RF energy by installing your antenna or antennas far from and at right angles to as many utility-related wires, seen and hidden in walls, as possible, using no more than 100 watts until ensuring neighbors are not experiencing sheer induction field RF overload is also encouraged. Remember, it is much more difficult to survive an interference complaint than it is to avoid the possibility of overload and interference. A recently noted case of TVI seemed to defy correction, even with the installation of snap-on toroids and a high-pass filter. Closer investigation revealed a haphazardly installed CVR with a continuously active broadband preamp connected to the TV's antenna terminals. The owner was using the VCR's built-in tuner as a remote-controlled channel selector for the TV. The area's TV signals were strong, and the broadband preamp was essentially unnecessary, but it could not be bypassed without internal mods, a liability no-no on neighbors' electronics. Therefore, the amateur generously purchased a new deluxe and RFI-proof VCR and gave it to the family. RFI was eliminated, and everyone came out a winner. Unusual problems occasionally require unusual circumstances. Let's sort of finish up looking at a contest to schedule, folks, for the latter part of February. Today is already February the 9th as I read this, so I'm going to give you perhaps from the 21st onward to the end of the month and some of March. February 21st and 2nd, the ARRL-CWDX contest. Also on the 21st and 22nd of February, the REF single sideband contest. February 27th through March 1st, CQ Worldwide 160-meter SSB contest. That's a biggie. February 28th to March 1st, North American RIDI QSO party. March 7th through 8th, ARRL single sideband DX contest. That's big for worldwide contest on phone, voice. March 28th and 29th, CQ Worldwide WPX single sideband contest. Another great contest. Featured by this particular magazine, CQ Magazine, Amateur Radio Communications and Technology. That's what I'm reading from today, folks, for February 2009, CQ Magazine, here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard S. Moss' son. Richard's call is W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Hand to Hand System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Hand to Hand members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Hand to Hands may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. That's handyham in lowercase, one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, at courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH geographic location is Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right here south of Boston, about 50 miles on Buzzards Bay near good old Cape Cod. Thanks a lot for listening along again here on the Courage Hand to Hand System Digest recording of CQ Magazine 73.